That stopped. Now it's recording.
Check, check, check. Sibilance. Bow, chicka, bow, bow. Welcome to the Martin Bailey Mystery Hour. Bow, chicka, bow, bow. Welcome to the Martin Bailey Podcast.
Photography Podcast.
Bow, chicka, bow, 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 bow. Bow, chicka, bow, bow. Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. Bow, chicka, bow, bow, picka, bow, bow, picka, bow, bow. Welcome to the Martin Bailey Hour of Mystery. Bow, chicka, bow, bow, chicka, bow, bow. Welcome to the Martin Bailey Podcast. Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. Bow, chicka, bow, bow. Welcome to the Martin Bailey Hour of Mystery. Bow, chicka, bow, bow. Welcome to the Martin Bailey Mystery Hour. Bow, chicka, bow, bow. Welcome to the Martin Bailey Mystery Hour. Here's your host, Martin Bailey.
Okay, so David's going to kill me when he finds out that I've just put that whole uncut version in there. But this is the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast, episode 362, and it's March 6, 2013. And to give you a bit of a backstory there on the intro, David Duchemin and I were, you know, we spent 2 weeks together in Hokkaido and with the Snow Monkeys until last Friday. And during the tour, a number of times, something wacky would happen and David would just look over, nod his head, and it would be the signal for a bow, chicka, bow, bow. And we just did it the whole time. And then towards the end of the tour, I decided, you know, I asked David to record an intro for the podcast. And that was just basically the uncut version of David standing in the bathroom with my iPhone recording it. And you can hear me sort of laughing in the background and stuff. It was, I don't know, it's probably not funny to anybody other than myself and David, but I thought I'd include that because it has me in stitches every time I listen to it. And so I usually record an update after returning from the Snow Monkeys and Hokkaido tour each year. And this time, obviously, David was with us. So we just finished last Friday. And because we were lucky enough to have, you know, the best-selling author and amazing photographer David Duchemin with us, we decided to sit down and chat about the tour together. And that's basically what I'm going to play you today, a recording of that conversation. Before we listen to that, I'd like to just mention that this episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, and now an online store. Check out their new commerce solution so that you can start selling stuff immediately. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new account, go to squarespace.com/MBP and use the offer code MBP3. We'll have more from Squarespace later, but now let's enjoy that conversation with David Duchemin. Okay, so it's great to be sitting here just less than a week after getting back from Hokkaido with our special guest, David Duchemin. Hi, David.
Hey, Martin. How you doing?
I'm great, thanks. Once again, you know, thanks so much for coming to photograph the Snow Monkeys in Hokkaido with us. I had a blast. I knew that I was going to be laughing quite a lot, but honestly, I haven't laughed that much in a long time.
And that was a good trip.
Yeah, it was just, I really did enjoy myself. And we're just going to go through and talk about the tour and, you know, some of your experiences. And I'll intermingle some of my thoughts as well. And we'll, I also have the recording from the bus that I'll put in at the end, and we'll just make this a your rendition of, was it Rocket Man? And you know what? Following the tour, I actually came back and I just had to buy Elton John's Greatest Hits again because I haven't got that on in iTunes at the moment.
Yeah, well, I apologize for that. The some of the music that came out during that tour and the karaoke was of some dubious taste, I must say. It's you know, now I like my music cheesy, but I mean, that was, we had enough cheese on that bus to melt a pizza, so
I usually have a cable with me that I plug my iPhone into the bus's stereo system and just play music. But we were singing it so much, it just didn't really make any sense.
Yeah, it might have prevented great evil from happening. That some of the stuff that, you know, I mean, by the end of the trip, I couldn't get some of this stuff out of my head. So I've actually declared my house a bit of a Elton John free zone for a while, just to. And then my manager Corwin, he did a dastardly thing today. We were working, and I saw him fiddling with my iPhone, and I didn't quite know what he was doing. And when I unmuted my stereo, he had ABBA's Fernando, which is the only ABBA song I have on my iPod, and there's a particular reason I have that song. And I, you know, I was listening to it because I was like, well, I'm not going to get up and change it. And then it played again, and I didn't really notice it, but I just, okay, whatever. And then, and soon it, this thing had played like 5 or 6 times. Like, what kind of man would do that to a friend? You know? So I'm not getting that song out of my head for months. Anyway, that's a digression.
Well, the listeners will understand what we're talking about later as we get into this, but also as I play the recording from the bus at the end of the tour.
Mm-hmm. So I guess we're abandoning that whole thing about what happens in Hokkaido stays in Hokkaido. Right? Absolutely. That's going right out the door, and we're burying our dirty laundry in front of everyone.
Yeah. So let's start off in Nagano. We went. You know, we start the tour and go over to photograph the snow monkeys in Nagano, which is about 3.5-4 hours sort of northwest of Tokyo. That was the first. I know that you've been around monkeys before, but that was your first snow monkey shooting experience. How did you find it, David?
You know, it was great. And in fact, you mentioned my experience with monkeys, and I have had nothing but bad experience with monkeys. I've had bad experiences with monkeys on 3 continents now, and some other time we can have a whole podcast about my monkey experiences. But these guys were really, really fun. I think because the tourists haven't been feeding them, and they've just been trained to behave well. So they were just doing monkey things instead of tormenting, you know, the photographers. But it was really, really fun. I mean, I think when you first encounter something that you've heard a lot about, that you've seen photographs of, my first encounter with the Japanese macaque was not in person, but first becoming aware of them was National Geographic, and seeing these great photographs of these monkeys sitting in a hot tub with, you know, snow on their head. And I thought, that's just fantastic. You know, I need to go and see that. So it was really fun for me just to finally see that after years of thinking, I can't wait to see that. Photographically, I was surprised by, you know, what a challenge it was. I think it's so easy. We've talked about this, about being, you know, seduced by your subject. And it took me probably the first full day. I just had to watch these things. And I mean, there were some great photographs that came out of it, but it really took me a while to kind of figure out what these monkeys were to me. Like, what was the... in fact, I was just writing a blog post about this, but, you know, what was the story there? There isn't always a story in our photographs. Sometimes a photograph is about, you know, it's more like a poem than a story. But with the snow monkeys, there was such a similarity to humans. It was so easy to assign human emotions and motives and actions to them that I found myself sort of sitting there and trying to figure out what can I do to make this more than just a picture of a monkey. And it was really neat to draw on my experience as a portrait photographer and, you know, doing some documentary kind of work, and then looking at these monkeys in this new way. It was really cool. As with everything on the trip, there was a steep learning curve for me. But what a blast to be in front of these characters, you know. I mean, I was surprised how close you could get. I mean, to be able to sit in front of these monkeys with a 16mm lens right up close, and to have them just give you no never mind. You know, once in a while a baby would sort of reach out and stick a fingerprint on your lens or something, but other than that, they just, you know, ignored you. Which, you know, to my delight, because I was terrified I was going to be sitting there and have someone climb on my back or, you know, fling poo at me or something. So it was, you know, if you have poo, fling it now. So anyway, it was truly, you know, the worst behaved, I think you would agree, the worst behaved animals there were the two-legged ones. There were a couple of photographic tours, one in particular, that showed up, and I was just really disgusted with their behavior. Yeah. And I mean, that soured it in a way that, you know, obviously no one but them could have changed. But it was too bad to see that kind of behavior. You know, it's just unacceptable. But the monkeys themselves were just super cool. You know, I don't know that people appreciate how rare. I mean, these are the, to my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, Martin, these are the only monkeys in the world that do this. And so to be sitting in front of these, you know, crazy little guys, you know, as they're having their hot tub spa treatment, it was pretty cool.
Yeah. The monkeys, the macaques here, or snow monkeys, as they're affectionately known, they're apparently they're the northernmost monkeys in the world. They live right to the top of Honshu, the main island of Japan, mostly in very, very harsh conditions. But that troop there of some 200 or so monkeys are the only monkeys that are recorded to actually bathe the way they do. And it is pretty special. You know, I'm lucky to live just a car drive away from them. And it's just, you know, it's always a pleasure. And I think I said a couple of times on the tour, I mean, it was the seventh tour that I've done with the group, and I've done private tours out there. And I just can't get the grin off my face every time I'm there. They're just so cute. Like you say, they're so human and you get so close to them. And for me as well, I mean, it's really difficult for me to get something that I haven't already done. And on the first trip out there this year, I actually switched to macro, and I was doing a lot of macro work, getting in really close on their faces. But they just don't mind you, do they? They're there. If you reached out, you can touch them, as some people have, and that's not a very good thing to do. But, you know, they're just incredible, and watching them play. I mean, it always amazes me how the young ones have got the mental leeway to actually spend time playing. You know, it's snowing. They've got to be cold. And yet they'll spend hours just running around and chasing each other around in the snow and pulling each other's hair and everything. It's just incredible to look at.
Yeah, good fun. There were some photographs that some of the other travelers took with the monkeys, you know, sitting on their camera bags and chewing on zippers. Yeah. And that really, I think, was the extent of our interaction, which, given my past with monkeys, I was quite thrilled with.
Yeah. Yeah. So after that, you know, we drive back to Tokyo. Actually, you know, before I go on, I did want to just touch on one thing that you mentioned there. I mean, one of the reasons we have, when we get to the monkeys, we have a half a day, then a full day, then another half day before we have to go back to Tokyo. But one of the reasons that I do it that way is to give people the time to sort of get used to the fact that they're standing in front of a troop of wild monkeys. And that, like you were saying, you need, you know, to begin with, you need a little bit of time to adjust and actually take in the fact that you're doing that. And so that's why I set it up in this way. And all of the locations that we go to, except for one that it's really just sort of a transition, we spend at least 2 days there. And part of that is so that I can give the group enough time to really become accustomed to what you're shooting. And generally you find that after the first day, or in the case of the monkeys, the first half day, you get back to the hotel and you start looking through images, and then you start to really take in the, you know, what you're doing and how you might improve the next day's shooting. So that's all done pretty much on purpose.
Well, I think it's important. I think, you know, and I see this on the trips that I've led on safari, where there is this tendency, the first moment you see an elephant, you know, suddenly you just, there's a blaze of motor drives going, and oh my God, it's an elephant, you know, 3,000 frames later. And you can almost count 24 hours before you hear the first person say, oh, it's just another elephant. You know, oh, what's that? Oh, it's just another elephant. Which is too bad that it ever becomes just another elephant or just another snow monkey. But I think, what happens when that lever gets switched is you're no longer shooting it. You're no longer just making a photograph of an elephant just because, oh my God, it's an elephant, I might not see another one. You suddenly, you know, at the beginning, excuse me, you show up and you see these monkeys and you say, internally you're like, oh my God, it's a monkey, and you're blasting everything.
Yeah.
When you realize they're not running away, when you learn to anticipate their behavior, when you realize that just because it's a photograph of a monkey doesn't make it a good photograph, then that you need that time. I think you always need that time. When I travel, I need that time when in terms of landscape and culture, and to get to recognize the things that I react to and go, oh my gosh, it's a fill in the blank here.
Yeah.
And then you know, you can get a little bit of maturity even over a few hours, realizing that this thing isn't going away, that it's, you know, it's so exotic when you first see it. But again, just because it's exotic doesn't make it a good or a compelling photograph. So you have to, I think, work through that, oh my gosh, it's a monkey, to get to the point of, it's just another monkey. And now you're ready to go, okay, now what is it about this monkey that can make a good, is it this monkey? Is it a different monkey? Let's talk about composition and timing. That, I think, is when those conversations internally start happening a little better. Otherwise, you would just get so distracted. You know, it's like if a model walked, you know, down the street, oh my God, it's insert model, Heidi Klum. What, you may fire off three or four shots, but that's hardly a portrait. You know, and if you really want to make a beautiful photograph of Heidi Klum, you need to spend a little time, you know, and get to know her and be in a situation where you can actually photograph them. And so I think that time that you give, that you allow, even though, you know, let's be honest. I mean, after my second day, I was kind of like, I'm so done with monkeys, but that's okay, 'cause I'm not done with photographs. And I think along this, you know, when we talk about not being seduced by your subject, I think that's really, that's an important point to get to when you realize, okay, you know, I'm kind of bored of monkeys. Okay, good. Now make some photographs, because this is about the photographs, not really about the monkeys. If it's just about the monkeys, leave your camera in the car and just go sit, watch monkeys.
Yeah. So, so what we did then, we flew off, we spent an evening in Tokyo, and then we flew over to Hokkaido and started the 9 days up there. And, you know, as usual, the island's magical. And I think at some point you were joking, you know, I know a good name for this, but let's call it the Winter Wonderland Tour. And of course, you know, that's pretty much what I've been calling it. And it's just, it is. I mean, to me, Hokkaido, although I love the other places that I go, and there's a load of other places that I really, really still want to go to, I just love the place. And I, you know, I'm hoping now, having spent 9 days there, that you can understand partly why. And so what we did was we started off, we had one day where we basically drove around, did some waterfall shooting, and then we were going to go up into the national park, the Shirutoko National Park, which is basically that horn, the peninsula on the northeast. If you look at a map of Hokkaido, there's this horn that pokes up. It's basically that peninsula. And we were on the east side, the west side. So we were in Utoro, and we were driving along, and you'd seen somewhere that you really wanted to. We went up for a walk in the national park, which was great, you know, but you'd seen an area down on the beach with some rocks and the sea ice, and decided that it'd be good to go down there. And of course it was. We jumped off the bus, and although the drop there and your past history had me a little bit worried for a moment, but you managed to, within, you know, by the time everyone else had gotten off the bus, you'd pretty much spied out a way to get down there, which we did. So, you know, obviously that location is accredited to you. Let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, did you end up with any really nice shots from down there?
You know, that's one of the funniest things about the creative process is, and about photography. You see something and you go, oh my gosh, look at that. I got to go. And by the time you get off the bus, which, I mean, is quite high. So the moment you step off the bus, the point of view has changed, unless you've got a ladder. You know, what you thought was there, maybe, you know, like a tree in a field, the minute you step off the bus, that you look at the tree and suddenly the tree's not really in the field. Suddenly it's, you know, set against the horizon, or there's a line of trees behind it to make it look funny. And so that was my first kind of, you know, we got down and I kind of went, this wasn't quite what I was expecting. And, you know, I Well, of course, we started shooting and the snow came in and it got so snowy that you couldn't shoot anything. I mean, it was just big snowflakes on the front of the lens. And so I was kind of frustrated because there were the great rocks with snow on top of them. And when we came back the next day, that, you know, there had been new snowfall and it was kind of all messy and it wasn't the scene that I'd initially seen. But what's funny to me is that I mean, we worked that scene like a dog, and some people got some things they were really pleased with. And I kind of left thinking, man, I worked really hard to get absolutely nothing out of that other than just enjoying the experience, which of course is, you know, it's not beside the point. That is the point. I think if you enjoy the experience, you have a better chance of making a beautiful photograph. But, you know, it wasn't until we came back up and I was standing on the, basically standing on the side of the road on the edge of this, you know, this kind of hill. And suddenly I realized I'd been shooting this thing all wrong, that I'd been so close to the water. And was when I pulled back, one of my favorite photographs is a photograph of that scene, but much, much wider and higher up and completely different. I mean, if you took the raw image, you know, from down on the beach and you just, and compared it, you wouldn't even know it was the same place except for the vast, you know, sea ice. But I'm thrilled with the photograph. I mean, it's one of my favorite pictures, not only from this trip, but, you know, from this year, but we're only a couple months in, so I've got plenty of time to move. But the, it was, you know, it was a totally different kind of thing. And you always have to, with landscape and wildlife, you have to be open to the fact that no matter how hard you try, the weather and timing and the light will not always be in your favor, you know, and with cold weather like we were in, you know, I'm used to just going, oh, it's, you know, I'll just throw my tripod in the water. Well, you can't really stand in the middle of water that's that cold without going hypothermic. And so, you know, next time I'll bring my hip waders or something.
Yeah, that was the place. I mean, I don't normally take them to Hokkaido. That was one place where, you know, I mean, I was standing sort of on rocks in the river, the little estuary sort of thing that was flowing down into the sea. But I ended up getting a reasonable shot from there, something that I like. I Silver FX Pro'd it, and I've got a long exposure from there that I'm happy with. But coming back to what you were saying, you know, I reckon that the scene that attracted you to that location was the one from the bus, which was the higher up scene. So thinking about it, you know, it's not really that surprising that ended up being what you found that you liked the most, you know, the shot that was after that, because yeah, that was what attracted you to the place in the first place. So,
well, sort of, except that I'd love to say that that's true, because that would at least make me sound like, you know, I knew what I was talking about. But it was from up on the bus, but looking down at that kind of that area where the sort of small river spilled into the sea. What I saw eventually that I liked much more was just the sea ice and the way it kind of came up on shore. So, you know, I think sometimes, I think we like to give ourselves a lot of credit for, you know, I mean, I talk ad nauseum about, you know, what's your vision for this? And I think that's important, but it changes and it's a moving target. Sometimes you see something and you think, oh my gosh, and it totally isn't what you think it's. It just works out to be total crap. But along the way, you have some other encounter, you know, some other moment presents itself or some other viewpoint, or it's that classic situation where you're photographing the sunset and, you know, you turn around and you realize, oh my gosh, you know, the thing that the sun is hitting is much better than the sunset itself, but you just didn't notice it because you're so concentrated on something else. And I think had I taken a little bit of time to scout, which I find hard these days, you know, I find it hard to walk and we have the snow in Hokkaido is just so deep. You know, there were a couple of times I wasn't sure I was getting out. Had I spent a little more time kind of scouting the area and seeing, okay, what's kind of past the edges of my periphery, I think I might have come up with that shot much sooner. But that's not the way I work. I've always learned the hard way, and I always kind of need to fall down a couple of times before I realize, you know, I got to not fall down anymore. And it's the same way photographically. You know, you make a couple bad frames, and they move you to something better, and eventually you come up with, you know, with something really, really that you're really proud of.
Yeah, and I think that's an important point. A lot of people see the final edited selection of say, you know, 30, 40, maybe 50 images from a 2-week trip like that. And there's probably in there, there's only going to be a handful of images that you'll really want to hold on to. And I, you know, I'll put links to these, and I've not read it yet, because I've only just noticed you posted it. But you've just posted an editing Hokkaido blog post about your process, and literally, you know, you end up, you come back from tours like this, you've got a whole lot of stuff to work through, and if you can basically boil it down at the end to a very small number of very powerful images, that's great. But the, you know, a lot of people think that they'll look at people like yours work and expect that you're sort of getting off the bus and or jumping out of the car, walking over to something, you know, set the tripod up maybe, and then it's just, okay, lots and lots of thought, and then you release the shutter and you walk away with the frame. And that's rarely how it works. I mean, you can look at, I'm sure.
Don't tell them that.
But, well, I mean,
he was just joking. It's totally the way it works all the time.
Yeah. I mean, you work a scene and you kind of edit it in camera, and you'll have a whole load of peripheral shots right up to the point where you get the one. And even sometimes you shoot past that and go back to one that you earlier found, you know, appealing. And it's very much an in the field editative process, I think.
Yeah, it very much is. Yeah, very much is. And, you know, people, as you said, they see that one beautiful shot. They don't see. I literally, Martin, I came home with 8,000 photographs, yeah. You know, and it wasn't that I was praying and spraying. But, you know, as I explained on the blog post, you've got, you know, all this snow falling, and you want to get the best chance of not having a snowflake over the monkey's eye, or right. You're panning with an eagle that, you know, now my D800 has just a ridiculously small buffer for this kind of thing, huge files. So I think it's got something like a 13 shot buffer. And so I would, you know, fire 13 frames and I'd be halfway through the pan going, oh, come on, clear the buffer. I need more. And, you know, it's like there's this little voice inside my D800 going, I can't push it any farther, Captain. I'm like, come on, you bastard. I got to tell you, I've never cursed at birds, my camera, or other photographers more in my life. Just trying to learn this stuff is some of it. I am not a wildlife photographer, and you know, to have to learn how to focus on a fast moving eagle. So a lot of that stuff was just me trying to, you know, figure it out and learn it. But you still, even if you're very careful about your frame rate, you're going to come home with a bunch of stuff that doesn't work. And you know, I'll be interested in your comments on my blog post later, because the editing Hokkaido blog post is really more about editing and the way I do it. And yeah. I'm very binary, and you know, you've got a completely different use for your star ratings than I do. But I think the process of choosing images, one of the things I said in the blog post is, you know, if you find yourself sitting there and trying to choose between two images and decide which one sucks less, you know, just do yourself a favor. They both suck. Move on.
Yeah.
Like this is, editing is hard. Photography's hard. Editing's hard. And I think that one of the best things that we can do is get tougher with our image selection. So people are trying desperately to, you know, what's your keeper rate? I don't have a keeper rate. In fact, the worse my keeper rate is, the better.
Yeah.
Because I want to have, my standards are, standards the wrong words. My expectations for my own art are constantly changing. And frankly, if I come back from a trip and I have 12 photographs that I love, that's way better than coming back with 100 that are just okay. What am I going to do with just okay photographs?
Yeah.
No one builds a portfolio on just okay, or moves people's hearts and minds with just okay. So it would be an interesting thing actually to teach, would be the, you know, the way we edit, not post-processing, but actually choosing our frames.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's complete diversion, but...
Well, no, I mean, yeah, it is, but it's, you know, it's important. It's one of those things.
It is. Shut up. We're moving on.
No, it is, but it's, you know, and I brought it up, but it's one of those things, you know, you just, like you say, everyone's got their own way of doing that. And we were talking on the bus one day about, you know, how we use stars, and that's all, you know, personal preference and whatever works for us. And I think you started, I've read the first few sentences before we started to record, but you also mentioned, you know, it doesn't matter what program you use to do it. You know, it's never going to be about the software. It's all about the process and within a relatively short space of time, get your images down to a fine selection.
And we'll pick up on the conversation and continue talking about the editing process and keepers, etc. in a moment. But I just wanted to remind you that this episode is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, and now an online store. Squarespace have introduced a new commerce solution that allows you to instantly create and store and start selling products. Squarespace Commerce provides a powerful and flexible e-commerce solution, integrated to work with every Squarespace template, allowing sales for both physical and digital goods. For example, you can sell music CDs or MP3s, hardcover books or ebooks, or in our case, of course, you know, we may want to sell prints or photography related goods. They have fast merchant account setup so that you can accept payments right away by credit and debit cards. Single interface for order management, tracking orders, providing customer email updates, and printing shipping labels and adding coupons. Squarespace Commerce is included with the Business Plan subscription, which starts at $24 per month when you sign up for a year, or $30 per month on the monthly plan. Squarespace gives you and your website users the best mobile experience. They've developed templates with mobile-ready responsive designs, which means that your site automatically restructures to look great on any device, smartphone, tablet, or computer. And of course, this means that you get a mobile-ready store with the new commerce solution. Squarespace is fast and easy to use. It has beautiful templates with 100% drag-and-drop functionality. You can automatically import, sync, and publish to and from social media with a few clicks, dynamically refreshing your site content and raising awareness in your social circles. Squarespace has an award-winning design team and user experience experts. Each template also has hundreds of customization options available to change the grid layout, colors, over 300 fonts, and more. Sign up for a free trial at squarespace.com/MVP, and you don't need a credit card, just try it out and start building your website. Then if you decide to purchase it, just use the code MVP3 and get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. And that includes monthly and annual plans. So obviously you'll make more of a discount if you go for an annual plan. And don't forget about the free domain registrations for annual plan customers as well. So that's squarespace.com/MVP and use the offer code MVP3 for everything that you need to create an exceptional website. And now let's jump back into our conversation with David Duchemin.
Yeah, when I look at the number of images that I shoot and the number of images that I actually show people, if you count those as being keepers, it's probably less than 1%. And but I'm happy with that because it means that I'm showing people only the best. And you know, some people have said, "Oh well, I've got a higher keeper rate than that." And I'm in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, "Yeah, well, look at your images." You know, it's like I don't want to be a snob in any way, but you know, you've got to increase your standards. You've got to make sure that what you show people is your best, the best of the best. And I think that whole process is really important and worth talking about. So I'm looking forward to going back and reading the rest of your post, and you know, I'll maybe do something similar, because I know that you managed to get through a lot of your images, at least your first pass while you were on the road. For me, I ended up, you know, on this trip, maybe because there was one or two more alcoholic beverages flowing than usual, I ended up just getting back to my room each night and just crashing, and I didn't really have time to do much editing on the road.
But yeah, I like how you blame the alcoholic beverages when it's you that's saying, "Hey, y'all, you got to wake up at 3:30 in the morning."
Yeah,
you know, yeah, it's the fault of the sake.
Yeah, so. Well, obviously, what I'm trying to do is to give myself enough sleep to be able to stay on top of things, because it is a tough tour. You mentioned that in your other Hokkaido recap, which I'll link to as well. You know, but I keep the troops moving at a pretty good pace. So
I'll say.
Yeah, so it's definitely, that's the main part. And I often end up coming back with at least a few days where I've been through the images, but this time it was really just a very brief look at the end of each day. But I'm almost done with the process. My first edit took me down. I don't know how many I came back with. It was probably about the same. But my first edit took me down to 500 shots, and I'm halfway through a second edit where I'm down to 200. I'm hoping that it'll be under 100 before I go through my second edit, and then I'll just keep whittling them down for a few more days. And maybe I'll be posting stuff on Google Plus, etc., you know, over the coming week or so. But it's a process. I mean, I enjoy the process. I remember, you know, Iberian X Perillo, and I remember talking with Iberian X a number of years ago and talking about how I'm happy with my workflow. And he was like, "What? No one's ever happy with the workflow." But I am. I mean, the software does what I want it to. I've devised a number of processes that just help me to get through large amounts of images relatively quickly. And so it's not painful for me. It's just it's time consuming, but it's definitely not a painful experience.
No, I think that's the best of both worlds, you know, and how can you not enjoy the edit in the sense that, you know, you spend all this time looking at these beautiful birds or landscapes, and then you sit back in front of these images and you have now you've got this sort of, I mean, you've got photographs of them, but you've also built into those almost kind of crammed into the metadata are your experiences and your memories of these places. And I absolutely delight in doing the edit process. It doesn't always make it easy. Sometimes it's just pure drudgery. But I think I've developed a system that works for me. But again, I think as most of the things we do, we have to ask ourselves why we're doing it. And if a photographer's chief priority, sadly, I think, is a keeper rate, then really what you're more interested in, I mean, that's percentages. And so what your hobby is not photography, your hobby is mathematics. And you should probably just get a calculator and play with numbers. If what you want is photographs, I can't imagine any other art form where they get together and this. So, you know, you sat down and you wrote some songs and, you know, how many of the songs that you started writing did you finish writing? And, you know, how many crappy first drafts did you write before you got to your novel? And because my crappy first draft to novel ratio is 5 to 1. And we must be the only artistic endeavor that has that strange obsession. Maybe I'm wrong. I'd love to be wrong, but it seems kind of unique to us.
And I'm sure you're right. There's, you know, people generally, I think it's partly because it's a technical pursuit, you know, and although the technique should be all muscle memory, and once you're actually doing the artistic stuff, it should all go to the back and you basically don't have to think about it. But at the end of the day, photography is always going to be a technical pursuit. And I think some people never really let go of that. They revel in the technical side and don't really think about the what comes after that. And so I think that's probably why some people will fixate on numbers and stuff. But
I think it can be, Martin. I think it's important for a photographer to ask themselves, is this for me a technical pursuit? Because for some it is. You know, I think I told you my friend Fernando said, David, some people play music and some people collect guitars.
Yeah.
Right? And I think it's the same thing in photography. For some people, it is a technical pursuit. But for others, I hope myself included, it's an aesthetic pursuit. It's an artistic pursuit achieved through technical means. And I split hairs on this because I think it's important. I think if it's a technical pursuit for you, then the point is the technique. If it's an artistic pursuit, regardless of how you pursue it, the point is the art. And I think understanding why we do this allows us to kind of make our priorities. Because let's face it, you know, if someone just wants to kind of have a big, you know, technical wank about metadata and how fast their cards write to their cameras, then more power to you. Just understand that that's technique and you know, kind of techno geekery. It's not art. Art is in, you know, something that moves us. And if you understand why you do it, I think then it's kind of like, okay, well, you know, I just want to go and make pictures of eagles because I like playing with my camera. Fair enough. Well,
that's kind of the point that I was trying to make, in that, you know, initially it starts off as something that's technical, but then you get past that and you want to consider, you know, you want to work at it from the aesthetic side. And I think that you mentioned there again that, you know, the keeper, it was collectors. I think that the people that never get past it as a technical pursuit are the people that are collecting images rather than, you know, wanting to refine a beautiful body of work. And so, you know, it's like they're the people that are going to be worried more about the collector rate, the keeper ratio and all of that. And sure. And if you, we're both saying here that our goal from any shoot like that is to get down to the smallest number of images, the fewest images possible that we want to show people, because we know then that we've really condensed it down to something that we'll be happy to show to people. It's not, as you were saying earlier, you know, just trying to decide which of the two crappier images will the best of the two crappy images. If they're crappy, just leave them out, you know. So I often get home after something like this and the emotion of the tour, you know, you've got an emotional connection. You were emotionally invested. It was minus 20. You were standing on the side of a mountain. You need to pull something out of that shoot to basically warrant the effort that you put into it. But that's not always the case. Once that emotional connection's gone, sometimes you didn't come away with something that's going to beat what you already have. Or, you know, if it's not going to be worth including it in your selection of best shots, then just get over it and walk on, move on.
Yeah, I think I totally agree. I think it's a shame though that someone could go to somewhere so beautiful and at the end come back and sort of, you know, on account of their, maybe they had a rough week and they shot a whole hard drive full of junk, that it would take away from that experience. Obviously, you know, we want our photographs to be solid and we want people to see them and be moved by them. But I'm a huge believer in the idea that, you know, you got to experience the place first. And honestly, I had such an amazing trip that, now admittedly, I came back with images that I love. And so maybe it's easier for me to say this, but I've been on some trips where I come back with nothing, literally nothing but crap. And that's not my modesty speaking. It's just crap. And yet the trip was amazing, you know. Yeah. And what happens as human beings, if you know, and photographers, is if we lose our camera while you're on a trip or it breaks, yes, it's depressing, but to let that spoil the opportunity to enjoy such an amazing place. I mean, Hokkaido is one of those places you just have to see to believe, because it truly is. And I, you know, we were not in the most remote of remote places. I mean, I'd love to see what this place looks like when you have to trek there in a 4x4 or, you know, backpack into the woods. I mean, it's a crazy wild place. I love it.
Yeah. So, you know, we touched on the Stella seagulls. We were talking earlier about how we, you know, we're on the boat, we're photographing the eagles. Let's move on and talk a little bit about that. You know, we 3 mornings, we're in Naosu, the seaport. It's basically a fishing port. We're there for 3 mornings, and this is really to give us the best chance not only to become accustomed to what we're photographing and improve on the second and third day, but also because our photography there depends on there being sea ice, and that can change, that can be blown out by a storm very easily, and it's possible that we could be there for 3 days and have no ice. So I like to sort of hedge our bets and spend a good amount of time there. But we went out for the 3 full days. Some days there was so much ice that we couldn't get even that far out of the port, which has its own problems, because the crows, as you saw, you know, some of the shoots, it was really difficult to get a decent shot because there was too many crows and seagulls. But, you know, how did you find the whole experience? You were talking about your buffer filling and that, but, you know, how was it?
Well, I've never seen so many damn crows in all my life, but or eagles for that matter. It was, you know, there was this one moment that I had where I just sort of, I put my camera down and I thought, I am the luckiest guy in the world. I'm sitting here in this sea, you know, in Japan, with a group of photographers that, you know, I liked well enough to, I'd travel with any of them again. And we were laughing and having a great time. And out there that we're all photographing are these massive, majestic eagles. And it just, I mean, it was breathtaking to stare through these big lenses. I mean, my arms were so tired after a day of doing that, but to stare through these lenses at these amazing birds, and they just kept coming, you know. And I think this is one of the things I like about photography. You know, I like adventure and creativity, I think, always happens outside of the unknown. So every time you think you know what's going to happen, you should probably brace yourself. Mm. And that was fun with the birds, because you just, especially for someone who didn't know them well enough to anticipate behavior, you just didn't know. And so it was this constant, it was like Christmas morning, because every time a bird was within sight, it was like, this is my own little gift-wrapped bird, and I have no idea what's going to happen. Is he going to fly away? Is he going to fly to me? Is he going to, you know, how's he going to land? It was, I mean, it was just breathtaking. It was really, really cool. And there were technical challenges. There always are. And so, you know, my challenge was, here's one of the things I learned on this trip, Martin. You, at the very beginning, said, you know, and you're very good at this. You tell people your settings, and, you know, I've got a handle on the technical stuff, but knowing what, for example, what f-stop you're shooting at is really helpful, because I default to something much lower on subjects generally, other than landscape, you know, where maybe you want F13 or, and when you said, I'm going to put my, you know, my f-stop for these birds will generally be around, you know, 10 or 11. And my first thought was, oh my gosh, that's retarded. What the hell is he thinking? You know, that background's going to be so detailed and chaotic. And I'm thinking, I'm going to go, you know, for me, deep is like F4, you know? And yet, because I'm a good student and I came to learn, I just put my shutter or my aperture where you suggested, and I did some test shots, and it was, as you said, you needed that kind of depth of field to get a chunk of the bird in focus. Mm. And with such long lenses, which I don't use that much. And when I do, I use them in Africa, and we're sitting in a stationary Land Rover, and the lion that we're photographing is, you know, practically asleep. He's so stationary. So it was a really, really good learning curve, and trying to figure out my focus modes. I never shoot in servo or any kind of continuous. So it was a nonstop, like my brain hurt some evenings from the sort of mental activity, because I normally operate in a very different creative space. Mm. And I think these are good exercises. I think we're constantly in need of being shaken up and having the paint stirred, because our brain fires in new ways. And really, when you think about it, you know, we talk about creativity in all kinds of mystical terms, and, you know, being inspired, and the you know, serving the muse, and that's all well and good. And I use that language too. Sometimes I overuse that language, but the reality is creativity happens in our brain. Mm. I mean, that's where the synapses are firing. And I think, with the exception of creativity enhancers like Japanese sake or soju or something like that, I think the brain is, it's like our idea factory. And one of the things, I was reading a book about, you know, how the brain works, just, I don't know why I was even reading it, but it talks about having healthy brains and not allowing, you know, the idea of a creative rut. It's not really even metaphor, that we fire these pathways in our brain more and more. And the more we keep in this sort of these same tracks, it's like we really truly are making ruts in our brains in a way. And it's really hard to jump out of them. Whereas if you're constantly trying new things and being challenged with, you know, a new language or a new, in photography, you know, go and shoot motorsports, or God help you, go shoot a wedding if you've never shot one, and it makes your brain work in new ways and different ways, and creates more of these pathways instead of just one really deep pathway that's very hard to jump out of. So anyway, that for me, the payoff was in sort of a new surge of creativity, because my brain was being forced to work in new ways. And it was kind of like saying to the idea factory, okay, folks, we got to rejig the machinery, and let's see if we can come up with something cool. Well, of course you can come up with something cool. The machinery's been rejigged. It maybe not cool, but it'll certainly be different, because it's different machinery and it's doing different things. And I came back with a body of work that I just adore. I mean, there's some stuff in here. There's even a couple of shots of, you know, the cranes that I haven't seen before. And I'm thrilled with some of the abstracts. And while others were trying to do more literal photographs, I'm less interested in that. So I was trying to do something more artsy. And I came back with stuff that I never would have imagined unless I'd been put in the situation and had someone not hold my hand, but someone sort of kind of crack the whip and say, do it this way, and this way, because that's what's worked in the past. If I had had to sort of figure out that all that stuff myself, I don't know. I probably would have defaulted to my old ways. So you know, and that's an encouragement to anyone that's listening to this. You know, you may not have an opportunity to do a workshop like this, but you can always be pushing yourself into new areas, not the comfortable ones, not the ones like, oh, that'd be really fun and it's easy, but like do something scary every day. Just go and do, you know, photograph something different, use a tilt shift lens. It took me 3 years to use a tilt shift lens, Martin, because I was totally terrified of it. It's like, oh my God, there's so many buttons and dials. And and once I got it in my hands, it was still scary, but it was more like, hey, what does this do? And what is this? And what if I, and suddenly it's like a kid playing with Lego, you know, you're building something, you know, no one else recognizes what the hell it is, but you're having a great time. And I think that's really important for the creative process. Even if all you're going to do is then take those new ideas and thoughts and then go back to what you photograph. I mean, it's very unlikely, Martin, that I'm going to become a wildlife photographer. I've seen the crap you guys carry. I've carried the crap you guys carry, and it's just too damn heavy. Mm-hmm. You know, I go to work with a tripod, a 16 to 35 millimeter lens and a few filters. And, you know, that makes me happy. But man, did I ever learn.
Oh yeah. I generally find, you know, with wildlife, I enjoy not having, when I don't have to carry all that weight, it's nice. But when I do it because of, you know, it's basically a means to an end.
Of course.
But, and I think there's, you know, on the aperture, all of that stuff that I shoot at, that I call out, my shooting stuff, is basically just the result of I think almost 10 years of shooting the wildlife in Hokkaido. And so I've just basically learned what works for me. And you know, I mean, I do sometimes when I've got my shots, I've got my insurance shots, I'll sometimes open it up and I'll shoot at F4 or wider, just to sort of to get something with a slightly more sort of ethereal feel to it. But you know, when you, especially if you want a whole bird that size in focus, you need a relatively deep depth of field. And with the focal length that we're shooting at, F8, I mean, I often default to F8, but like you say, sometimes 10 or 11. But you need that sort of depth of field at those focal lengths to get the bulk of the bird in focus. If you shoot at F2.8 or F4, you might be lucky to get the eye and a bit of the head, which is great. I mean, for portraits, that's perfect. But it also makes it really difficult to nail the focus on a flying bird just on the eyes. And so, you know, with the group, it's kind of the way I call out the settings. And I think it gives the group the best opportunity to actually nail some shots. So,
absolutely. You know, but let's be honest, it's hard to nail the focus on a moving bird when you're at F10 anyway. So yeah, F2.8, I don't know what I was thinking. I mean, a couple times I was completely disobedient. I'm like, oh, to hell with that, Martin Bailey. I'm going to go 5.6. And actually, if for portraits, I got a couple that I am just over the moon about. Mm. But I think if I looked at the bulk of my work, uncharacteristically, you know, most of the stuff was shot at 8 and 10. And so again, you learn when you're forced to do something you don't normally do. And now I realize, you know, on these longer focal lengths, I can get away with a bit more depth of field without it, you know, changing the visual mass of my background and cluttering it up. And, you know, I've been doing this 25 years and you're still learning new lessons in some of the most fundamental things, like hockey skaters. You know, hockey players will do the basic drills over and over and over again. You can't forsake the fundamentals. And unfortunately, I think we all do that as a matter of almost a matter of habit. Mm. You know, you need to sit down and do your as a like a pianist. I mean, you're learning to play the piano. You got to sit down and do your chords.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
You got to do your scales over and over and over again. Yeah. And even when you get very good, you still are going to sit down and do your scales over and over and over again.
Absolutely, yeah. So after that, you know, we did a few little landscape shoots and things between the main locations, but after the eagles, we moved around and we moved to an area where there was hooper swans. And, you know, some people I know that they come on the tour. These are the least endangered. In fact, they're pretty common birds, but they're still quite beautiful. You know, they're just all white with that big yellow beak. And I quite enjoy shooting those guys at the Kusharo Lake. Do you have any takeaways from that, from the swan shoots?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a little bit like it's a little like crows. I mean, crows are pretty common too. And I've seen some amazing photographs of crows if you allow yourself to, you know, to see the beauty in them. But I think because photographers so often chase the extraordinary or the exotic, we forget to see the exotic in the mundane. And yeah, they may be very popular, you know, prolific birds, these swans, but they were gorgeous. And I think to get over that, I mean, maybe the next question is, yeah, I went to Japan to photograph these, you know, Hooper swans from Siberia, but what is it near me that is, that I'm overlooking because I've written it off as mundane? I mean, we were just by a lake photographing swans, but I got some images again that I'm thrilled with. I mean, they're when you look past the fact that they're, you know, quote, just swans, they have a, I mean, they have a comic side to them when they're taking off or when they're landing. There's, you know, especially with those big flipper sized feet, and you know, they're very ungainly, and there's a comic side to them. There's an incredibly graceful side to them, and the white on white allowed, you know, to play with some very, you know, very, I never heard the word minimalist so many times in my life. I heard every photographer say, oh, we're going to shoot some minimalist stuff. And I'm not mocking. It truly was. I mean, if you glance through my, you know, my selects on Lightroom right now, I mean, the whole screen's practically white, you know, it's white with a little gray. It's white with a little black. It's light with a little bit of yellow. You know, you get to the cranes and, oh my gosh, it's white with a little bit of red. It's a very subdued, beautiful, peaceful, serene color palette. But the swans were amazing, you know, and it was truly fun. I do get a kick out of, you know, sometimes we as photographers, because we were there, we see what was in the scene all around us, 360 degrees, and we hear the sounds. But as soon as you put it into a still frame, you're excluding an awful lot. Nobody that wasn't there would know. And so I do get a kick out of seeing these very serene photographs of swans in flight and then remembering, you know, what it took to get these things. And, you know, it was, I mean, we're just at this, we're basically at a little park at the side of a lake where we're, you know, feeding geese over on one side and then running over to the other side and feeding them. And they would just, the swans would just be like, oh, the food's over there now. And they honk and honk and honk and honk and fly in the air or run and, you know,
and but it's jazz interesting. Playing.
And there's jazz. You know, there was one moment where I was lying on the beach and I'm photographing and I'm half in the water and I'm photographing and I was thinking, this is so great. I'm lying on a beach. I'm photographing swans. I'm in Japan. And then there was a moment I went, wait a sec. I'm listening to Miles Davis. How is this possible? And then I realized this is the best kind of wildlife photography. I'm on a nice beach. There's geothermal activity. I'm kind of warm. Swans are beautiful. And I got, you know, I don't even need to put my iPod on. I just have Miles Davis playing in the background. It was truly amazing. So if you could work something out with the skipper of the boat, and maybe have, you know, when we do the Eagles, I'd like some, I don't know, you know, Ride of the Valkyries or something, you know, some, maybe just pipe Wagner over the speakers.
So, yeah, just to let the listeners know what I'm talking about here, because I've never mentioned this yet, but the place that we photographed the Hooper swans, there's two locations, and one of them is literally right next to a large touristy, like a souvenir shop and restaurant. And they literally just have, they've got speakers outside and they're piping music out. It's not huge, not really high volume, but you can literally just sit and listen to it and enjoy it. And they were playing jazz for pretty much the whole 2 days that we were there. So it was a lot of fun that way. But
I'm just grateful for their musical taste, because I had to, you know, to listen to, you know, the pachinko song or something, I would, I probably would have killed myself or perhaps someone else.
Yeah. So, you know, the swans, for me, the highlight of the swans was that last morning before we moved on to photograph the cranes, when we went down, we'd done the Bihoro Pass shoot, which is basically where we climb a mountain. And that sounds really romantic. It's basically we get off a bus and walk 10 minutes uphill.
Yeah, you're shortchanging this, Martin. So for those listening at home, let me just hijack this for a moment. So this is the morning Martin says, so this morning we have to get up early. We've been getting up at 4:30. We're leaving at 4:30, you know, 5 o'clock. And this time he says, so this morning we're getting up early. And the alarms go off at 3:30 and we leave at something like ridiculous, like 4 or 4:15. It's minus 20 gazillion 11 or something. And Martin, there was a point when I'd set up my tripod and I was photographing and it was so cold and I'm trying so desperately to keep my breath going down so it's not fogging up my viewfinder or my eyeglasses. And I'd been there so long, my mustache, you know, it had iced up, but then it froze to the plate of my tripod. And so I'm sitting there and I'm literally attached at the lip to my tripod. I can't move. And I'm thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do? Like, I can't walk down this hill with my tripod and my camera frozen to my lip. And so, you know, I started kind of licking and heavy breathing. And I, for anyone that was, you know, that was looking on, it must have been the bizarrest experience. You know, it was really, truly beautiful, but, you know, writing it off as a simple, yeah, we just hiked up a mountain and made some photographs. This man knows how to march his troops, folks. It was really, it was truly, truly fun. I have photographs that I took of myself, and I was just grinning ear to ear, you know, and we had to, you know, wear headlamps to get up there. And it's the kind of thing that I absolutely thrive on. But, you know, you're short selling yourself if you try to convince folks that this is just a leisurely, somewhat early morning hike up a hill.
Yeah. Well, thanks. You're right. It is more than that, but we go up there. And I love that place. That's where we've had minus 37 in the past. And so it's a harsh morning. It's an early one. And so, you know, it's definitely not an easy sort of morning stroll. And I think there was, I also noticed this year for the first time that the Elsa inside the 5D Mark III, all of this screen is done with basically, I believe, with like LCD liquid crystal stuff. And when I was focusing, the little squares are supposed to snap on, little black squares in the viewfinder. They were sort of fading in, and then you'd take your hand off, and then they gradually fade out. It was so cold that literally the liquid crystal was freezing and not. It was really slow how quickly it reacted. So it's cold. It's a lot of fun.
It's got to be one of my favorite mornings on that trip. It was that shoot. It was really, really fun.
Yeah. And I saw your photos of the trees on the way up there. They really are classic. It's a beautiful spot. What we did was that was the first morning. And because we managed to, you know, that first morning panned out, we got our photos down of the sunrise over the lake. The next morning, we did have a little bit of a lie-in. And I took the group back to the Kusharo Lake, hoping to capture the swans as they flew in, because there's normally only a few that spend the night there. And it was misty, and this is one of my highlights. It's actually only the second photo that I've uploaded to Google Plus, although I wanted to do more while we were traveling. But it was misty, and the swans. We waited. We had an hour that we could spend there before breakfast, and then all of a sudden we heard the honking, and this group of swans in the frame that I just posted on Google Plus. There's seven swans coming out of the mist. And these are probably going to be some of my favorite shots of the year, even though I'll be doing other work. The light was just beautiful, and it's just white on white on white, you know, and you've got the mist, the swans, and the snow and the frozen lake at the bottom. They really are just, they're great locations to be shooting in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're gorgeous. That morning was really something. It was beautiful.
Yeah. So after that, you know, we were basically by this point, coming up to our last 2 days, we headed over to the Red Crown Cranes. And, you know, it's getting, you know, it's great that the crane numbers are increasing. There's over a couple of hundred of them now compared to just a handful, half a century ago. But, we went over to the Red Crown Cranes. I know that you were doing some of the abstract stuff. That's the sort of stuff that I love doing there as well. So, you know, how did you find the cranes? What really excited you about them more than anything?
I just loved the shape. You know, first of all, it was a very challenging shooting environment. I mean, you know, you're not exactly walking among them. I mean, they're out there, and you're kind of behind a fence, and There were a lot of photographers. So
the first day, especially,
it was unbelievable. I mean, it looked like the Crane Olympics or something. And I think so. Something that's so hard to photograph anyway was made more difficult by there was no possibility to change your POV. If you wanted to move over 6 feet to the right, you were just out of luck because there was no 6 feet to the right. There was just, you know, a tourist with a camera and then another one and then another one. And some with, you know, I've never seen such rigs in all my life. Martin, there were people there with like four cameras mounted to a tripod and every possible long lens I've ever seen. And, you know, I frankly felt kind of a little bit self-conscious with all these, you know, guys with gigantic lenses. But but having said that, all that does really is set you up for an opportunity to be differently creative and go, okay, so my liabilities are these, and so I'm going to shoot something else. And it pushed me into seeing the cranes in new ways and kind of getting away from the literal representation of, okay, here's a crane. I have very few pictures of just the crane. I mean, I have a lot of very close up photographs, and those that I do have were from the sanctuary where we went, and there was a little bit of snow falling in the distance, and it's more of a landscape with a crane in it as opposed to a photograph of a crane. Yeah. But I think what I like so much about them is just the black, white, and red. If you can get the right combination and you can separate them from, you know, the kind of treed woody background and put them in a place where you can focus on these elements. They're just so graceful, and they have these beautiful big eyes and a little bit of catchlight in the eye. And you know, of course, the feathers have so much texture, and their necks are long and have these graceful lines. So for me, it was, and the light was just perfect. I mean, the light was subdued, and it was like having a big softbox. So there was no fighting with shadows, and I could just focus on lines and moments and gestures. And so photographing these beautiful, I mean, they're already beautiful, but just a photograph of a beautiful crane is not necessarily a beautiful photograph. Mm. So working through that and saying, okay, now how do I make a beautiful photograph of a crane, and one that isn't, I mean, I haven't seen a lot of crane images, probably, I mean, yours specifically. But I try to sort of insulate myself. If I'm going on a trip, I don't look at a bunch of crane images because I don't want to know what's been shot. I don't want to know what my possibilities are. I want to solve the problem myself, and I don't want to be tempted to replicate in some way an image that I've seen before. I don't want to be the guy that's standing there going, oh, I saw this really great shot. That's the one I'm looking for. Because in looking for that one shot, you're going to miss 100 others.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's the same reason when I go to a location, I don't generally read my Lonely Planet books or Google, you know, like Google image search where I'm going. I like to be surprised. And yes, I miss things, but nobody sees the photographs you missed. So it's totally beside the point. But I think one of my favorite images from this is, you know, you can't see the eyes, you can't see the beak. It's on this Editing Hokkaido blog post. And it's just sort of it's almost like a top view looking down at the head of the crane. Mm. Although you're looking at it from the side and he's just craned his neck around, but it's just an abstract study in form and color and there's no rule of thirds in this. It's right smack in the middle of a square frame. It's very abstract. And every time I look at it, I just get this big smile on my face because it perfectly sums up, you know, my feelings about the thing. For me, these weren't birds. For me, these were they were birds, but for me, it was about shape and grace and form and elegance and serenity. Mm. And so I made a photograph that captured that. And if every other photograph I took on this trip had failed for one reason or another, I wouldn't be mourning the loss of those. I would still be celebrating the fact that I made this image that comes so close to what I thought and felt that, you know, it's worth the 8,000 frames of garbage to get there.
Well, I don't know about garbage, but it's I'm totally with you. And it's difficult now to get, you know, because there are so many cranes, it's difficult to, even when they dance, it can be really hard to single them out and without one or two more cranes in the foreground or background and or background. And so, and also the weather conditions. I mean, they look beautiful when it snows, but unless it snows, you're dealing with a very high contrast ground. And so, you know, doing stuff like that really just sort of isolates them. It's the sort of thing that I love to do as well. And people generally will come away, you know, you get some flight shots. We try to use two bodies so that if one flies over, we can get a flight shot of them in the air. And that's always nice too. To a degree, though, a lot of the time we're trying to get shots that kind of just represent the fact that you've been there and that, you know, you want your own shot of the cranes. And I think that you really start to personalize it when you just isolate them and do those abstract sort of things. And I mean, I love doing those as well. I often call them studies. I don't know if that's the right way.
Sure.
Yeah, but they're great to do. And I love the ones that you shot on this trip as well. So I'm looking forward to seeing the rest of the stuff. Are you going to put? Will you actually use the images, put them somewhere as a body of work, or will you just sort of trickle them out into your publications and things?
Both. They will definitely. There is already a small collection that I'm building that will definitely form a body of work. I sort of surprised myself. I don't often put anything into a 16:9 frame ratio. Mm. In fact, I very much favor sort of a 4:5, which is a little closer to square than even the traditional, 4:6 2:3 ratio. And so a number of the images ended up as horizontal 16:9s, and I started playing with kind of creating something that had a visual unity to it. And I've got a collection of images, not all of them 16:9, but the 16:9 ones especially are they work really well together, and they just seem to really express how I feel about this place. So they will go onto my website fairly shortly, actually, and allow people to take a look at them. And I'll probably add a couple of the non 16:9 ones, but and then of course I'll trickle them out to books and that sort of thing. But yeah. I came away with, I suspect, right now in my selects, I think I have, well, maybe I don't even have it on this laptop yet, the collection. But I probably have, well, certainly over 100. Some of them duplicates, because I got two frames of a monkey, both that I really like, and I just need to get back to it and go, okay, which gesture is stronger? Different than looking at two and thinking, okay, which one sucks less? I have two that I really like, and I want to just kind of go back and maybe look at them for critical sharpness and that sort of thing. Yeah. But I will come out of this with a collection of sort of a body of work, and then some that don't maybe make a unified body of work, but that I would consider certainly strong enough to either, you know, sell as prints or put out into the stock world, or just into my books. And, you know, and I do so much teaching that a good photograph of a snow monkey that I have no intention of maybe putting into a body of work, because it maybe doesn't play well with that body. I can still use that photograph, you know, for the cover of an ebook or even just on my blog. I mean, I like to roll out new stuff on my blog and say, hey, here's something I'm working on. It doesn't necessarily go with a body of work. I mean, but it doesn't make it any less beautiful necessarily.
Yeah. So what I'll do is, obviously that's not ready right now. Is it okay if I lift a couple of the images from your blog post to put into this blog post to show people the work that you were getting?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And there are, I did a couple postcards did one from Yamanuchi and a couple from Hokkaido and stuff. So there's a few links there that people can see it, but feel free to lift whatever you like.
Okay, that's great. So what I'll do is, for the listeners here, I'll put a bunch of images of David's in before, when I release this podcast, which will be later today, but I'll also later on, I will link to David's post, and I'm sure that, I mean, you, I can't imagine that there are many people that aren't already following your work. So it might be a redundant act, but I'll definitely link back when David posts something, later on, I'll put another link into the show notes for this reactively as that comes out. But David, it's been really nice talking with you today about your experience on the trip, and it actually gave, because normally I come back from these things and I talk about my experiences and the things that I found cool about the trip. But it's really nice to be able to talk to you about your experiences and use some of your work as well. So thanks so much for sharing that with us today.
Well, my pleasure. And thank you again for being such a wonderful host. It was truly a fantastic fantastic trip. And, you know, I had a conversation with a friend the other day who was talking about doing one of my workshops. And I said, you know, honestly, you've already done one. I said, if you're going to do something, you know, go with Martin somewhere, you know, go to Iceland or something with Martin, because you really will learn a lot. And you and I have very different teaching styles that I think complement each other. But, you know, for anyone that's done any of my adventures, to go on something with you, I think would truly complement that and be a really great experience.
Well, that's really kind of you. And, I mean, hopefully this is not the last time we'll be traveling together as well. So, excuse me. So hopefully people will get a chance to travel with both of us again at some point. That's something that people can hopefully look forward to as well.
Yeah, I have a feeling.
Okay, well, really, though, thanks so much, David, and we'll catch up again soon.
All right, man. Take care.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Okay, so that was our conversation, and now I'm going to play you the 10-minute or so recording from the bus on the last day as we headed to the airport.
Okay, so we're now on the bus on the way to the Kushiro Airport after the 7th Martin Bailey Photography Winter Wonderland Tour. I've had a great time. We've got a wonderful group with us, and I'm going to just record a message walking around the bus, seeing how everyone thought about, you know, how everyone felt about the tour. So, Leonie.
Watashi wa Leonie desu. This is, I am from New Zealand and currently live in England. This is my first time in Japan. I have never been so cold or so happy. Martin has been incredible. I've learned so much. I'm very, very grateful. Okay. Arigato gozaimasu.
Do itashimashite. Here we go, Sarah.
Hi, I'm Sarah Slade, from England originally, now living in Italy. My first time in Japan, I had no idea what to expect, and I was maybe a little bit nervous, but it was absolutely fantastic. It's just been one highlight after another. It's been absolutely fantastic, Martin. You've been great. Your support, your encouragement, your teaching has been wonderful. The organisation and Yukiko's help has also been fabulous. Can't say enough good things. Thank you very much.
Thank you. FECO, it's your turn.
Pachinko!
Okay, that redlined the recorder.
FECO, thank you, Martin. Thank you, David, for being a comedian. And thanks to everyone. It was a great time. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Chris?
Hi, I'm Chris from Melbourne. We've had an awesome time, really well organised, really incredibly lucky with the weather, company, companionship and laughter. We've had a ball and learnt heaps. Thanks, Martin.
Okay. Richard, second time on the tour.
Hi, I'm Richard from Lake Macquarie in Australia. Yes, this is my second Martin Bailey Winter Wonderland tour for very good reason. The first time I had a great time, and the second time I've had a great time as well. The highlights of this tour were, of course, the animals, fantastic animals, great scenery, great people to travel with. Also, Martin's mentoring with the photography will never be forgotten. It's been fantastic. Thanks, Martin.
Thank you. Thanks, Rich. Byron.
Byron from British Columbia, and being the first time here in Japan and first time on Martin's tours, I can honestly say that I've learned a number of things. Martin's expertise in the field of photography was certainly a delight, but for me, what stood out the most was the fact that I had an opportunity to enjoy Japan that, without Martin's ability and knowledge and language, would more than likely would have been improbable. Having said that, I can say that I have come away with a number of images, but the most important images that I have are the people and the leader that I've involved myself with on this trip.
Very kind. Thanks, Mark. Chris.
Hi, my name's Chris. I'm from Montreal in Canada, and I came here for the snow monkeys, but fell in love with the eagles. I could do that all week long. Had a great time on that part of the trip. I am now officially a bird photographer. I really fell in love with that too. It was my first time doing wildlife, birds anyways. And Japanese snack food is the best. I had a great time.
Okay,
Carl. Hi, I'm Carl from
Minneapolis, Minnesota. This was a great trip, both for the photography and for the deep immersion in the Japanese culture that we all experienced. It's one of the best trips I've been on.
Thank you very much.
Tilo. Hi, I'm Tilo from Nuremberg, Germany. And it was my first real trip to Japan, so I'd like to thank Martin for this great trip, for this great opportunity, because I saw nice places. I saw the wildlife photography. I'm normally not in these kind of wildlife photography, but I really enjoyed it and learned a lot. And yeah, it was a great time. Thank you.
Thank you. Duncan.
I'm Duncan from West Australia. I say Duncan. Yeah, I've had an amazing time the last 2 weeks. The Japanese are amazingly polite and had a great time.
Okay. And it's been great speaking to you in my home language, my home tongue.
Okay. Hello, my name's Barbara. I'm from Dunedin in the South Island of New Zealand, so I didn't really notice the cold. This is the second time I've teamed up with Martin, so I sort of kind of knew what was going to be expected in the workshops particularly, but the Japanese chocolate and sake is just second to none. Thank you.
Thank you. Jörg, also a repeat offender.
Yeah, this is Jörg from California. I'm now with Martin for the third time in Hokkaido. And as in the previous trip, it has been a great trip in terms of lots of food, lots of photographic opportunities for birds, landscape, and a surprising number of photogenic trees as well.
Very good.
Nice one.
Okay. So, Alan.
Hi, Alan from Boca Raton, Florida. First time in cold Nagano with the snow monkeys. We're very photogenic. First time climbing up the mountain there and climbing up the mountains in Hokkaido for the beautiful birds. Had a great time. Very entertaining with David and Martin. Good food, nice people. Would love to come back.
Okay, we'd love to have you, either on the tour or just in Japan. Okay, so our special guest on this tour, I know that many of you already know, but we were joined by David Duchemin, and it's been a total blast. I know that not just me, but the whole group have had a blast spending time with you. So do you want to say a few words, David?
No. Yeah, what I want to say really is bon chicka bon bon. It's been truly a pleasure to travel with you and everyone else on this magical rolling mystery bus. I think it's going to be a long, long time until touchdown brings us back around to find... I'm not the man they think I am at home. No, I'm a rocket man. Probably the highlight of the trip, apart from the food and the company and just the photography, was our little impromptu karaoke session. And Daniel is leaving tonight on a plane. I can see the red tail lights heading for Spain. And anyway, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so... Really, that's it. We'll wrap it up there. But I wanted to just say thank you once again to all of you. It really has been a pleasure. And I hope that we get a chance to do this again sometime.
Next week.
Okay, next week will work. Okay, thanks everybody.
Thank you.
Of course, the whole thing would not have happened if it was... Well, it would have happened, but it wouldn't have happened anywhere near as smoothly if it wasn't for Yukiko. So before we wrap this up, we're going to have a word from Yukiko.
Hi, I'm Yukiko from Yokohama City. And I had a very great time, very enjoyed it. And I do greatly appreciate for all of you, my guests, kindness and cooperation. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for Martin. Arigatou gozaimashita.
Thank you. Okay, one more round of applause for you.
Thank you very much. Arigatou gozaimashita.
Thank you.
Wow, we really did have a blast. It was so much fun. So if you're interested in joining a future Winter Wonderland workshop, they will happen in 2014 again and for the foreseeable future. But if you're interested, details will be released very soon, probably by no later than the end of March 2013 for 2014 dates. Booking will start then, and you can find all of the details at mbpworkshops.com. And if the details are not there, or if you'd just like to be kept up to date with anything that I'm doing, I've got the Iceland tour. We have 3 spaces on the Iceland tour in August, September, still free. And there's new stuff being released all the time. So if you want to be kept up to date on that, go to mbpworkshops.com and just click on the newsletter button. And that way you'll get an email from me when new details are released. You'll never be spammed, and you will never have, you know, we'll never share your details with third parties or anything like that. But it's a great way of keeping in touch with new tours and workshops that I'm starting. And just really, some of them, like the Winter Wonderland one, just keep doing them year in, year out. Keep in touch that way, it's the best way. And I am going to sign off for there. We have another great chat with David coming up next week when we talk about the business of photography. So thanks very much for listening. I hope you tune in again next week. Remember that you can find me on Google+ and Twitter, etc. And links to everything that I'm up to are on the top page at martinbaileyphotography.com. So do drop by and take a look. I'll be back next week, though, with another episode, that chat with David. But in the meantime, you take care and have a great week, whatever you're doing. Bye-bye.